Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. Glad to have all of you with us today. If you're listening in real time, it's Friday afternoon, and a quick survey of all of the people who are gathered in the studio for the show today is that if you're not on the road now, you better get on it fast or not at all, because apparently spring break traffic has really hit us hard. Michael Owens, Cobb County Democratic Party chairman, raced in. I think you've been seated for about 20 seconds because the traffic was so hard to get here, right?
That's right. That's true. I obeyed every speed limit and ordinance in the county and the state, but I made it here.
All right. Well, we're glad you are here, as a matter of fact. Before I introduce everybody else, let me just remind you that you can tweet us at PoliticsGPB, and we hope you will be a part of the conversation as we go through the show today. Also, we are, as usual now, on Facebook Live. Just go to the GPB News page on Facebook Live, and you can see what's going on in the studio. Jim Galloway, the lead political writer for the AJC, is here. He writes in the paper on Wednesdays and Sundays, and of course he oversees the Political Insider blog at Politically Georgia, part of myajc.com. It's like nesting Russian dolls, Jim.
There we go. Yeah, but it's worth it when you find it.
That's exactly right. Loretta Lepore is with us. She, of course, has been a Republican strategist. She is also Governor Sonny Perdue's, was Sonny Perdue's communications director, went on to be a chair of Carly Fiorina's presidential campaign here in Georgia. And you've had a busy session? Because you've been doing some government affairs work down at the Capitol.
I have. It's really been a watchful session. So just there's been a lot of traffic this year.
Yeah. Okay. Buddy Darden is back. Former Democratic Congressman Buddy Darden joins us after an adventure in Italy.
That's right. The long-suffering Ms. Darden and I spent 2 weeks in Italy celebrating our 50th wedding anniversary, but it's always good to be back. Well, by the way, I've been around the state since I got back and have been so surprised and pleased to see how far-reaching our program goes into the outer reaches of the state as well as the Atlanta area.
Well, that is good to hear, and I am very happy with the kind of feedback that we get on the show quite frequently from people out there. As I said, Michael Owens, the chair of the Cobb County Democratic Party, is with us today as well. Okay, so let's get right to work. We really do, though, need to start with, before moving into any issues moving forward, Jim, sine die finally happened at about 10 minutes after 12 last night. We were on the air, of course, with a special edition of the show yesterday at 2 and talked about some of the bills we'd be watching. And we can now talk about the resolution of some of them.
Yeah, we actually have a commuter rail bill that's passed, presumably will be signed by the governor, or commuter rail or transit, depending on what do you want to call it and what county wants to call it what. It's one of those bills that was passed, and now we've got to read it to find out what was in it.
Yeah.
And to figure out, okay, if you're in Cobb County and you want to get into this thing, into this network we call the ATL, what do you have to do? If you're in Gwinnett, there's another set of rules for you, and then there's another set of rules for North Fulton. Those are the big three players in it.
Loretta, one of the things that on the show yesterday we were tracking was the difference between, one of the differences between the Senate and the House version was the governance of this new regional transit, 13-county transit district, for want of a better word. On the Senate side, there was a measure that Galloway pointed out to us would essentially give the next governor of Georgia a great deal of control over the system. Of course, Casey Cagle was the lieutenant governor, the president of the Senate. That would have been to his advantage. And on the House side, they had a more complicated structure of a lot of county officials all working on a board. And I think I'm correct, although Jim's right, we're going to have to look at the language. The governor is not going to have the kind of control based on the bill they passed, or am I wrong about that?
No, that's correct. Actually, the governor will appoint the chairman of the new governance council. And so the primary difference between the two bills in the Senate, the members of that governance council, there were fewer of them, and they were elected representatives. So they were county commissioners, mayors, people of that nature that would sit on that. In the House version, those seats are defined by essentially traffic flow. So there are projects within each of those, and those individuals will be elected by their local leadership. It'll be a mix of county commissioners, a mayor, and their legislative delegation will be able to select those members. And so the difference here is that a lot of folks in the transportation space in general and transit in the transit space prefer to have it be non-political, because what we saw is the way the Senate bill was structured, it was structured much like the 2010 Transportation Investment Act, which really was geopolitical. And it's part of the reason why it was so painful to try to come to resolution about what those projects were going to be.
Yeah.
This way, it's going to be defined more so on how does traffic flow, and those regions should represent a certain flow of, projects.
You've got 10 districts, and they're made up of 13 counties. So you have counties that are in multiple districts. I think Cobb is in 3.
Yes.
Well, the city of Atlanta, I know for sure, is in 4, and the mayor of Atlanta will have a say in all 4 of those. Because she will have a voice in each of those groupings, because it affects each of those 4 districts will overlay with the city of Atlanta.
One of the big headlines on this, though, buddy, is there's a genuine state investment. I think critics would say nowhere near what we need in an ongoing way. But not only does the measure allow for each of the districts, we can have a vote now on whether or not residents of the area want to add up to a 1% sales tax to pay for transit moving forward. But the state's put in, at least through bonds, an initial sum of what, $100
million?
$100 million, which is unprecedented for the state of Georgia. Now, true, it's not the kind of money it's going to take to build out any kind of a system, but I think it represents a substantial commitment by the state of Georgia and quite a change in the way of doing business in the past.
Yeah, and this will be used as a kind of an infrastructure bank.
Right.
I'm pretty sure.
If
I could put a question to Michael. Michael, I was looking through this morning about who voted for this and who voted against it. A lot of Cobb County Republicans voted against it. Including Ed Setzler, Lindsay Tippins, and such. But I also noticed that David Wilkerson, he's a Democrat out of Austell. He voted against it, and he was one of the very few Democrats who did. Do you know why?
To my recollection, he was the only Democrat that voted against it. I think there was Carson, Matt Dollar, Ed Setzler that was part of Cobb delegation. But from what I understand in speaking with David Wilkerson, that the concern is that if you go back and look at the bill talking about building the special tax district,
right,
that would come in. Representative Wilkerson's thing has always been about, I want to do what's best and right for my constituents within my area. And if I'm going to be part of this tax CID or this tax district, what are my constituents going to get for it? And why are they going to be subject to a tax that for real that's not going to go through their area or not directly benefit them? So that was my understanding, his premise on that.
So in the original bill, it was that district, that special district in Cobb, was essentially mirrored the Cumberland CID district, which is the business district that already agrees to tax its businesses, tax themselves for infrastructure improvements within the CID. And initially, that's how it was set up. Then there was a lot of debate amongst the Cobb delegation. And I think this was an attempt to allow the full delegation within Cobb to give back some local control and let them determine how they want to structure that special district.
Yeah, you know, I was actually on the floor last night, and I remember when Chairman Tanner came up to talk about the bill. And he says, look, we're really going to strip this down. And two things really stuck out to me. I think the first one, well, if we talk about Cobb specifically, it was a what seemed to be an ongoing litany list of steps that it would take to get Cobb fully on board with this.
It's really Byzantine.
Right? I mean, he really kind of went through it. So it's first, you know, the Cobb delegation got to do this. And, you know, so it was a litany list of things to go through. So we'll have to see with that, right, from the Cobb delegation and then with the Board of Commissioners and then on to the voters. But the other thing that I noticed that he said was that Greta was still going to be – it was ATL Transit was not going to replace –
Georgia Regional Transit Authority.
Yes, that it was not going to replace that, that Greta would still have its place as an authoritative board on most things outside of – this light rail or transit.
All right, now I'm starting to get confused, buddy.
My only observation, Bill, is as a Cobb County, and since all these concessions were made to Cobb County and they were given the special status and all these concessions, Why in the world would they turn around and then vote against it? They got pretty much what they asked for, and then they turned around and said, no, we're not for the bill. I really don't think that's a very sound legislative judgment in my part.
And I don't think it's representative of Cobb County as a whole.
Well, but it is representative of the tremendous split you have in Cobb County between those who live closer into inside the perimeter in like the Cumberland district and those who are far up in Ackworth or whatever and simply don't want to pay for transit.
Right, and then there's another split within the split, and you have Cobb is a rapidly changing county demographically, and you've got Democrats kind of on the cusp within the next cycle or two who are probably going to take a good bit of control over the operations. And I think the last time I saw David Wilkerson, who we mentioned, voted against it. Last time I saw him speak about this, he was asking, even begging for a seat at the table. He did not feel that he was in the room where all these decisions were being made.
All right, well, we're going to have to weigh that. Everybody's going to read through the details of this bill, as Jim said, and as they emerge, we'll be able to report more on it. I do want to say, Councilman Khalid tweets from South Fulton, something that I wasn't aware of. He says, one interesting detail of the bill is that any county in Georgia can be part of this ATL master plan. He asks, Athens, Macon, Savannah, why not? I'm interested in that because I'm not quite sure how that would work if they're separate. Khalid, if you have some thoughts on that, tweet them back to us.
There's an early part of that bill that says, and I hope I'm reading this right, Loretta, is that says any two counties in the state that are contiguous can get together and they can form their own transportation plan.
All right.
It's outside the bounds of the ATL.
It's outside there.
Then that's the answer. All right, let's talk about a couple of other bills. First of all, a big one that we all watched very carefully that passed is the distracted driving bill. There was some question for a while as to whether it was going to or not, but this is the bill that will, and now awaiting the governor's signature, which would mean that you have to use a hands-free device if you are going to talk on the telephone while you're driving. Buddy, this was a debate that played out pretty aggressively between personal freedom and public safety.
Yes, it did, and I never thought it would pass, even though I think it's good legislation, and I think that most statistics show that you're more in danger from distracted drivers than you are drunk drivers these days. So my personal experience has been I've changed my mind on this, and I think Representative Carson's to be commended on moving it forward. I don't think the governor has played his card yet, but I'll be surprised if he vetoes it.
Yeah, I will too, yeah.
Yeah, he will most likely sign it. He had a very funny comment last.
He endorsed the concept a couple of weeks ago when it seemed mired.
Yes. By the way, he had a very funny comment, I thought, last night about this when asked about it by reporters as the session was, you know, winding down. Did he support it? He said, the bigger thing right now is Sandra, his wife Sandra, and I haven't driven ourselves for 8 years, so we're going to be a danger on the road whether we're talking on our cell phones or not. He said, if you see him coming, you might want to get off the road for a few minutes.
The same is still true of Roy Barnes, even to this day. So that's always a problem.
One of the things that, another quick one before we move on, is they did pass a sales tax on online purchases. It's purchases over $500, I believe.
Right, the company has to sell $250,000 worth of goods or make more than 200 sales. So that kind of defines what type of business is subject to this new law. And then the individual, if the business does not collect, then if an individual buys more than $400 worth of purchases, they pay it.
Now, the question here becomes, the Supreme Court ruled some years ago that you had to have a brick and mortar store to collect a sales tax. But the Supreme Court, and this is why deal may or may not sign, but the U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to take this up again because the proliferation of online purchasing has become so vast since that first ruling.
Right, and one thing to keep in mind, one of the bragging points of this session, especially among Republicans, is going to be a quarter percentage point reduction in the state income tax. But I will tell you, if this internet bill is enforced, it pretty much will negate all the money you saved at that point. from the income tax.
Which is a consumption tax, right?
Yes, yes.
Which has been the argument for, that's kind of been the counterbalance to the state income tax.
You know, people have attacked Amazon over this, and they've done it incorrectly. Amazon, a number of years ago, I don't know how many, several years ago, agreed to pay sales tax in most of the states in which they operate. So, for instance, here in Georgia, they're already on board with that. So those people who are arguing that, oh, this means for sure Amazon's not moving here, they just don't have their facts right on this, unfortunately for them. So let me go on to the other big one, or one of the other big ones. Jim, we said yesterday on the show, transit for urban areas, big, big effort to boost the economies in rural Georgia, broadband proliferation, all of that. How did the recommendations on the economic bills for rural Georgia fare?
I believe all the broadband bills passed.
Yes.
And that included one that when we had Rusty Paul and Teresa Tomlinson here, they did not like it. It kind of put a cap on what cities and counties could charge internet providers for rights of way, and allowed them to put up their poles much more quickly.
Okay. Yeah.
So there's also a bill, by the way, which enabled the EMCs, authorized them go further into the internet business as well. Something we had talked about before.
Yeah, it was something that was in state law. It was vague on whether EMCs could become internet providers. Now they can, and that throws a lot more competition into the game.
All right, hopping around, here's one that failed, and it got a lot of opposition toward the end of the process. Michael, I thought that replacing Georgia voting machines with machines that would allow a paper trail was on the road to passage. But then again, some opposition, really vociferous, loud opposition, and the bill failed.
There was a tremendous amount of opposition for it. Lots of people kind of got on the side of, we want verifiable ways to verify paper ballots. The whole barcode issue came up, right? And no one was really seemed to be happy with that.
Barcode issue meaning that a barcode wasn't, reading a barcode off a ballot wasn't really enough to claim that you have a paper trail.
Verifiable, accountable, right, results from voting. The other issue that was always at hand was, you know, what system we're going to go to. How long was it going to take this system to get rolled out? What kind of testing you were going to do to get all this in place for when we're proposed to go live with it? So it's one of the things where I think there is some traction now. We know that this has raised enough noise where there does need to be a good bill put in place. But I think it needs more work. It needs more time. I don't buy this thing of non-hackable machines, period. I mean, of course, I take that approach that any machine is hackable. But we do need more time to put into it to make sure we get a good, solid system in place and have the surrounding infrastructure and surrounding processes to go along with that as well for full deployment of this.
At some point, Loretta, they're going to have to start the process. Somebody's going to have to take it up.
They are, and it's probably going to be on the plate of the new Secretary of State, whoever is elected in November. The federal government is sending down, by way of grant, $10 million
right,
for a new electric system, and that there's a state match to draw that money down. And so there will be funds here, and if something is not done, the federal government might take that money right on back. And so while the effort to put in new machines is going to exceed that dollar amount, it would behoove the state to move forward with a plan.
Secretary of State Brian Kemp has, of course, had his difficulties with voting groups out there that have been uncomfortable with the way he runs elections, whether they're correct or not. It's been an ongoing argument. To what extent, Jim, did that play into the opposition that didn't want Kemp to be in a position before leaving office, since he's running for governor, to be in a position of being involved in this process? Or am I making something up?
I don't think that was really much of a... Everybody understood that he was running for governor and he wouldn't be around for this argument. And yes, have there been some questions about how he's handled data in his office? Yeah, but I think that's more fodder for the gubernatorial race.
Okay.
Yeah.
Frankly, I think Secretary Kemp would be glad that it was passed by this time, because let somebody else worry about it, because he's got to concentrate on his campaign full time, and that's the last thing you needs is his worry.
That's a very good point. The bill to limit early voting on Sundays and forcing the city of Atlanta to be to set an election voting day schedule that's is in compliance with the rest of the state, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. The city of Atlanta stays open till 8. That failed as well. Probably people who thought it was a voter suppression effort are very happy today about that, Loretta. But others say, wait, why should a particular area of the state have additional time to vote? That's not fair either.
Right. So, so Josh McCoon, Senator McCoon, who is running for Secretary of State, this was his bill that he was moving forward, and it was a two-parter. So there was that piece in there about, making the closing time for voting consistent. There was also a piece in there about how special elections are run in these doing away with jungle primaries so that you do have Republicans and Democrats on every ticket in every race. And so I'm not sure which side of the House bogged this down. I think definitely to your point, there's been a lot of discussion about whether this was voter suppression. And I think Andrea Gillespie on the show made the point that if they wanted to make them consistent, they could make them all close at 8.
Absolutely. Yes. Right.
And so that seemed to be a valid point. And I think closing, the counterbalance to that is if you're going to close or close the polls an hour early in Atlanta, then you really need to allow for the early voting piece. Right. And so when you're doing both, I think that fed more into the discussion about voter suppression.
Michael, one of the reasons that jungle primary issue is there is right up in your territory because
it's
that sixth district congressional race where you could have had a Democrat win that thing because of the general ballot. There weren't separate Democratic and Republican ballots.
Yeah, it was two issues and they actually overlaid. One was the sixth congressional district race, obviously, where we almost won that, right? 48.1% or whatever. But then on the heels of that, you turn around with the state Senate District 6 election, where Democrats actually put two candidates into the runoff, so right, effectively freezing out the Republicans.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but I got to get a break in. When we come back, we'll talk a bit more about the legislature, and then we're going to turn and get Michael Owens' expertise on an issue that he knows very well. This probably one of the worst government attacks on a computer system that any of us can think about, what the city of Atlanta is dealing with. And we'll get into that, plus any number of other issues, after this break.
Hey, this is David Green, host of Morning Edition. I'm here to talk with you about that poking feeling, the one that keeps reminding you to support public radio. You can support the programs you love by donating your used vehicle. That old car or truck could be worth hundreds of dollars to this station. All you have to do is call, and you might even receive a tax deduction.
Go to gpb.org/cars or call 877-GPB-1-CAR, and thanks.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Michael Owens, Buddy Darden, Loretta Lepore, Jim Galloway in the Political Rewind studio right now. Tweet us at PoliticsGPB. Watch us on Facebook Live at the GPB news site on Facebook. Buddy, you said there's something you wanted to mention.
Yes, I just want to note that for the next 40 days, you're going to see the exercise of the ultimate power of the governor's office, because he holds all the cards. He holds all the legislature in his hand. He has a line item veto and is one of the most powerful offices of governor in the United States. You're going to see the ultimate exercise of power, and everybody except Nathan Deal in the state government is going to be extremely nervous for the next 40 days.
Okay, what's your bet? What does he veto? Name your best veto chance.
I don't have one at this point. What's yours?
I'm thinking maybe he dips into this Eagles Landing Stockbridge stuff, but I am not sure.
So help. We want to keep this simple because we haven't spent a lot of time on it before. But this is an unusual situation, right, Jim? Because this is the first time ever that a city already in place has been essentially been raided by a jurisdiction that wants to create it. Bring it into its jurisdiction,
right? With the help of the legislature, it is a. This is in Henry County. Stockbridge is a well-established city. I think maybe 100, 150 years old. It is African American majority. as Henry County is rapidly becoming. You have some people, and there's been testimony that there are some in the business community who are not comfortable with that. So they are taking roughly enough of Stockbridge to deprive it of half its own tax base, and combine it with some unincorporated area and create the city of Eagles Landing. Yeah. There's some really serious questions about what do you do? I mean, does Eagles Landing take over half of Stockbridge's debt? If not, who's responsible for it? Does the state have any liability if Stockbridge goes bankrupt as a result?
I think it sets a terrible precedent. And if you do it now, wait till the legislature changes over, and they'll look back on this as, well, they did it back in 2018. And so I agree with Jim, and I also say that I think it sets a terrible precedent for the future.
Michael, one of the hotly debated pieces of legislation out there, although it was eventually watered down, was the Senate bill on requiring local law enforcement to cooperate with ICE and turn over to them anybody they picked up who they determined was here in as an undocumented resident. It was watered down from Shell to May, but even then, and this was something Casey Cagle really put his muscle behind, and it failed, which is, I wonder what that is. How does, if you were his consultant right now, because he's going to be tough on immigration. He sees it as a route, as are all the Republican candidates.
Right.
How would you play that if you were working for him? What would you tell him?
Oh.
Be a Republican for a minute.
I'd tell him back away from it.
Well,
to be his consultant, you really have to. At first, I would just have to assess what is that going to do to the election, right? I mean,
there are two things that happened with this bill. Number one, the House Public Safety Committee tacked on a clause that went after the bail reform that the city of Atlanta went,
yep.
And it may have contradicted what Deal was trying to do in other legislation.
Yep.
Then I was talking to some in the Capitol to some opponents of this legislation yesterday. And what they were telling me was that there was some very quiet but very insistent pushback from South Georgia, from sheriffs in South Georgia, who didn't want to have to.
They don't want the burden.
They've got whole economies based on the agriculture,
yes,
and getting those crops picked.
We've already started to hear about that, right? With agricultural problems that are already having in South Georgia, where they're already talking about it. And this, unfortunately, I'm very happy because there's a trend that's already started and that continues to go. Deportations have gone up 52% over last year in Georgia. Georgia, I think, had about 14,000 arrests. So this coming together with ICE not only causes the problems with some of the agriculture and folks that are here, want to come to do work or whatever. But the issue is, how much do you align that? Georgia is having a problem now nationally when it views us that how friendly we are as an inclusive state. And it's not simply about, legal versus illegal, documented versus undocumented. It is really how we treat our fellow citizens.
Well, I would say, back to your original question, I think in the primary, this may not be as big an issue for Casey. It may be perceived that he made an effort and wasn't successful.
Yeah.
I think in the general, though, it becomes a bigger problem because, there was a letter that was written by a coalition of immigration groups and minority groups to Facebook and Amazon saying that Georgia is an unfriendly place, an unwelcome place for outsiders. And that letter was signed by the Asian American Advancing Justice Atlanta, the ACLU of Georgia, Coalition of Refugee Service Agencies, Georgia Association of Latino Elected Officials, the Georgia and Alabama Chapter of American Immigration Lawyers, and the Georgia NAACP.
All right. It's been a fascinating session, and I'm sure things are going to pop up, especially as we go through the veto period, that we'll be able to talk about. Before we get off, anybody else had anything on their radar that we really need to talk about with the legislature right now?
Is that the election's already on, and last night I saw a couple of ads on broadcast TV, Casey Cagle. Yeah. So The election is in full swing.
Yeah, every candidate's donation button is on and ready right now.
I think the only other thing really to point up is when we touched on rural Georgia, that there was a lot of advancement in terms of health care for rural Georgia this session, and that is critically important to those communities.
And let's commend the governor for fully funding K through 12 for the first time in many, many years. This has been something that we've been embarrassed about over the last 10 years or so. And I want to commend the governor for stepping up and finally making things right.
And I would say, from a purely partisan standpoint, that those things that actually were successful, if you look at the criminal justice reform, fully funding public schools, discussion around mass transit, those are Democratic ideas. And I'm proud of that.
All right. Let's move on. Michael, Jim Galloway made a good suggestion to me as we were getting set to go on the air. He said, before we talk about this extraordinary ransomware attack on the computer system of the city of Atlanta, we really ought to make sure that people understand your credentials in working in cybersecurity. So first, take about 30 seconds to tell us where that expertise comes from and how you deal with issues like this around the country, and I think beyond the United States.
Some international, yeah. So my background has historically been in IT for the last 20 years, literally building systems, I mean, kind of all the way up. A lot of the work that I started doing really started coming in internationally in the security space. I've designed networks, I've built them, I've maintained them, and I've started working internationally where, you know, most of the public entities are maintained by the government in other countries. So I started working with a lot of government entities around building secure environments and securing those, and then really moving into the cybersecurity space, focused around securing companies, making it work within their business goals, and then particularly on those policies, right? So I work with a couple of organizations. I have my own firm, and then I also started an NGO called the U.S. Center for Global Policy. So in that, we look at cyber legislation, not only nationally, but internationally as well. We look at what China's doing, we look at what Russia's doing, and we see how that legislation affects what's going on globally and how we can respond to it here in the U.S. And work with companies. I work with companies every day as far as how you look at how you're building out your cybersecurity plan, your incident response plan, which I think we'll talk about, as well as how they're building out their networks, right? And how they're training their people, because that's a really large part too. So it's training, it's hardware and software, it's people and processes, and it's the tools that you use to safeguard yourself.
So thank you for that. All that said, the city of Atlanta essentially it went into paralysis. Its computer systems shut down entirely by a ransomware attack. What's a ransomware attack?
Sure. So a ransomware attack is... It's basically software that when it gets into your system, it encrypts your files. It literally gives an encryption key code that locks you out of all the data on every machine that it touches, and it basically requires you to pay up X amount of dollars. That's why it's called ransomware, right? In which they will give you an unencryption key that you can then use to get your data back. So you enter it back in, you get your data back. Most of the time, it's kind of crazy to say, but they're honest thieves, right? Meaning that if you pay up, right, they most of the time give you the key, because if they don't, right, then there's very little incentive actually for people to pay up after that. So most of the time this will happen. It can get in various different ways. The most profound way is through phishing emails, which are basically targeted emails which are fake. It makes you think the emails is coming from eBay or Amazon, let's say online retailers, banks, anywhere that you may have an account, and they'll say, hey, there's a problem with the last order you did. Click here to resolve it. It's not the Nigerian prince type thing, even though, you know, that's a whole different set of issues. But it's really about being really smart and crafty about how to get into your system.
The
other way is that systems can be misconfigured or not configured correctly so that they leave themselves open to the internet where people can just basically walk right in.
Right. So this hits with a new mayor in place. And Jim, on one hand, early on in this, it appears you could say, wow, it's awful that the city of Atlanta was victimized by some malicious actor out there who wanted to collect this ransom. But we're beginning to learn that perhaps, and your AJC reported it today, perhaps the city was not as diligent when first cautioned about this potential problem. They tend to want to blame it on the vendor, that it was software that they bought from a vendor that brought this in.
But apparently there were some warnings that went out that were just some patches that were intended to fill those holes that Michael was talking about, and they weren't implemented. They didn't get filled.
Yeah, that's now what we don't know is if that's directly related to this or not. We know that there was look, I could go into any firm, I could go into any company or any municipality and go through their network, and I could find a litany of things that were wrong. So to say that the city of Atlanta, that they found something that was wrong, they need to address, it's not the silver bullet necessarily, right? It wasn't necessarily that server particularly that happened. It just says that, yes, there were patches that need to be made. They could have strengthened or hardened their systems.
Nevertheless, yeah, go ahead, Loretta. Well, simply that I raised the question of this occurring early in the tenure of a new mayor. There are, unfortunately, the buck stops at the desk of the new mayor, and so this becomes, in a way, and the reason it's really worthy of conversation on this show is it becomes a political a problem in some ways in terms of your faith in the city government and in how it's responding to a crisis, yes?
Well, I think two things. I think, to Michael's point, no matter how smart you get as a company or a government, the thieves get even smarter. And as smart as the technology gets, then the thieves get smarter again, right? So it's a constantly evolving situation. I think the unfortunate thing for Mayor Bottoms is that she's come into office and she doesn't even have staff in place. She doesn't have a chief technology officer in place. She has a deputy in place, but not a chief technology officer. She doesn't have some senior staff in place to help navigate and manage through this process. So of course, it does go more directly to her to have to handle and be more hands-on.
Michael, you said that rapid response would become a part of this discussion with the city of Atlanta. Well, what are you seeing?
Yeah, so not only is Mayor Bottoms new, they also lost the CIO, Samir, who went to New York. They lost the chief information security officer prior to that. So there is a kind of a huge transition that's kind of taken place. But one of the concerns with this is the response is how fast do you move? And some of that can be directly dependent on how well prepared you had been previously, right? One of the main risks for this is, the discussion is the ransom is $51,000, which I think the city of Atlanta could easily pay. However, you have to be careful and ensure that you have actually contained, that there's a cyber kill chain that it's called, right? That you've actually contained this threat that's on your network. If you have not, that it could easily actually come right back and reinfect the network, and you're right back where you started. We recently saw this as well in Colorado. Colorado just had the same exact attack, the SamSam ransomware attack that happened there, and the same thing happened. They actually thought they had it eradicated, and it came right back and reinfected the network all over again.
Yeah, so for people who haven't followed it closely, buddy, lest you think this is just a problem for somebody working in an office at City Hall who can't get on their computer, this is, I want to pay my water bill.
Yes.
I have a court case. I'm on the docket. I'm supposed to be in traffic court. This is a major problem for the citizens of Atlanta and beyond who are doing business in the city of Atlanta, buddy.
It is, but you've got to remember we got along before without it, and so what we'll have to do is just figure some way to get around it until it resolves.
There's
itself.
The old school, buddy Darden. We're going to do without computers, darn it.
No, we're going to get by without them until they're resolved.
It is convenient for constituents who are doing things online. It's an inconvenience.
Right.
But it's also affecting revenue for the city.
Yes.
So, they're not getting their bills out. And then pay, the one thing the mayor said when she first came out, your paychecks will not be, you will receive your paychecks, even if we have to cut them by hand, you will receive those. So, there's a lot of instances and it's like a domino effect. I have a house closing coming up and the folks who would be in charge of that can't get to the information they need from the city. So we're having to go dig through and find receipts to present. So there's a lot of things that you don't think about on a daily basis that are impacted.
Michael, who is this SamSam group? I mean, are these local guys, or are they foreign? Are they Russian?
The hardest thing to do with any of this is attribution, right? Because the code could be written by Russia, but it could be deployed by North Korea, right? It could be deployed by someone who went and downloaded the software and has it on their own computer, actually just sending it out, scanning it. My thought would be that if this was an actual directed attack against the city of Atlanta, the ransom would have been a lot more than $51,000. That's my own personal thought from seeing these things and how it works, is that $51,000 is kind of a generic number, and they could have just been out scanning networks. And if they were just scanning networks and they got in, then it pretty much could have been a generic type thing. But knowing that you're vulnerable now, right, who's to say you don't get this fixed and someone comes in 2 weeks from now and does the same thing at $1 million?
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, Michael, but oftentimes these folks, they're just pinging. They're just like they're pinging all the way down the road, and then they hit when somebody opens a file they've sent, right? And so even as a small business owner, one of the ways that they're trying to become more clever is to try to get you to open attachments from other software providers. So imitating Microsoft or imitating, and those are things when you're a business, you're like, oh my gosh, I've got a software issue with my business software. I've got to address this. You click on something and then all of a sudden, poof. You're infected. You know? Right.
Now, let me tie
Last
it. To,
word on
let me
this,
let me tie
Michael.
This back right to politics and to the election. I mean, the legislature just went through Senate Bill 315, computer crimes bill, has basically it was proposed to take this scanning that you were talking about, which is the way that most of these vulnerabilities are found by third party groups that are doing security research that scans these companies. I got personal friends that do this, scans these companies, and when they let them know that there's a vulnerability. Senate Bill 315 would make that illegal. So there is, we have to be very careful when we're trying to do the right things to kind of find these vulnerabilities and be able to reduce them versus criminalizing the people that are actually trying to do this work.
All right. Thank you for that. I feel like I'm living in a Michael Crichton novel when I think about the way you discuss these things, Michael Owens. We do have to get another break in as we go to break. Tom Faust, Buddy Arden at the beginning of the show said he's always happy when he goes around the state and hears people are listening to the show. Well, Tom Faust just sent me a note saying that our Facebook Live viewers right now are coming from places like Villa Rica, Jasper, Austell, and other locations in the state. And I also very quickly, Stephanie McGarity tweeted, what about Bill? And I think she means House Bill 999. It didn't get much attention. That's the bill that would have denied people with a history of mental illness access to weapons. That bill went nowhere. It was another one of the gun bills that failed. Thanks for the tweet. We'll be right back.
We call them flying mice, but bats are actually more closely related to horses and whales. I'm Ira Flatow. This week on Science Friday, the amazing airborne antics of bats, from swift pivots to Olympic-level flips. That's all on Science Friday. Same bat time, same bat station from PRI.
3 o'clock this afternoon here on GPB.
Jim Galloway, David Shulkin was ousted as the Secretary of Veteran Affairs the other day. President Trump once again didn't talk to him directly. Apparently, the newest reporting on it is that the president and Shulkin had a conversation shortly before he was dumped, and the president didn't mention it.
Yeah, noting all his accomplishments and where they were going next. It was, you know, and then next thing he knows, he gets a call from Chief of Staff John Kelly.
Yeah. There's been reporting that the president informed him on a tweet, and there are a lot of people in the liberal commentary world that want to say, here's example again of Trump being unable to fire. But it didn't happen a tweet. At least he did get the Chief of Staff to call him. Maybe not the best way to do it, but let's at least be accurate.
Yeah. And it was what's unusual about this is this happened maybe a week, maybe 10 days after Johnny Isaacson said that he had a White House conversation with the president and saying, David Shulkin is doing an excellent job. He needs to be kept on. We don't need to have the turmoil that would come with a, with another confirmation hearing on this.
And of course, the reason, Loretta, it's important that Johnny Isaacson be involved in this is he's the chair of the Senate Veteran Affairs Committee, and he's given a lot of credit to Shulkin for really helping fix the massive problems that the VA has had, and clearly is none too happy that Shulkin's out.
Involved with veterans over the years. And so he's been working with the secretary very closely, and his office has been working with the secretary very closely. So in the minutia, right? So he knows exactly what's been handled there. And so this was probably came as very disturbing news to him and how he's going to have to now readjust as it is for most in the veterans community. I think there's concerns about, you know, how will this be handled given the new incoming secretary's background and whether he's prepared to take on this.
It makes very little sense, in my opinion, to have Shulkin go out, because the one thing Johnny Isaacson will say is that this man has been doing a good job. They've been working together. They've achieved a lot of things. And you're looking at the second largest department in the United States government. You're looking at a budget of $200 billion and a lot of money out there. And I'm so sure many of you read the article in today's New York Times by former Secretary Shulkin saying that he believes there's another agenda here and that people are looking at trying to privatize a lot of these functions so they can get in some of the action. And whether this is true or not, there's certainly a lot of smoke here, and it'll be interesting to see where it goes from here.
Yes. Okay. All that said, Shulkin is being very critical. He feels like he was being undermined by Trump administration appointees who were put in the VA system. There's now a lot of controversy over the appointment by the president or the nomination by the president of his personal physician, Ronnie Jackson, who has no administrative experience whatsoever. But Michael, let's have a level playing field. There is an IG, an Inspector General report, which is very critical of Shulkin for having gone on a two-week trip, a European trip, took his wife. The IG's report says that they did mostly personal touring, traveling, sightseeing. And so it was critical of Shulkin. If we are going to sit in this studio and say, well, an IG report shows a Trump appointee has misused federal funds in some way, there ought to be action taken against him. Well, let's be careful about not paying attention to an IG report which casts maybe a negative light on the way Trump got rid of Shulkin. Does that make sense?
It makes sense.
But
okay, I'm going to take a slightly different thing. As a veteran, right? I'm going to look at this from the veterans community, and the overall concern is that are we getting the rug pulled out from under us, right? Was there actually a bold leader that was in place that was taking the VA off of, you know, critical care and starting to move things in the right direction? The obvious question for this is, what does this do for the veterans that are out there, right? And is Trump loves to beat his chest and talk about how he really cares for the veterans. Was this move made to provide better care for the veterans? And that's what it boils down to at the end of the day. You know, the politics aside, it has to be about the veteran and the veteran
care. That's a really good point. And, Jim, that's one of the concerns about this nomination of Ronnie Jackson. And Johnny Isaacson's going to be right in the middle of that.
Right. And it was interesting. I mean, in the press release, the only thing we've heard from Isaacson on this, you know, he heaped praise on Shulkin, said Shulkin has provided Donald Trump with his best string of legislative victories. Yes. Since he was sworn in. He had a single line devoted to Admiral Ronnie Jackson, basically saying, I don't know this man. I need to find out about him. The worry among veterans is that with privatization, what they're afraid of is the VA would become nothing more than a financial pass-through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
From the federal government to private entities that may not have the expertise when it comes to dealing with things like amputees.
Yeah.
And mental and physical trauma that are kind of specialized.
Yes.
To people who have been in battles.
Well, but the issue of privatization in and of itself is not always a negative. I think where we have an issue here is you have to have a very special leader that understands privatization, because you have to have oversight and you have to understand how that works. And so the concern, I think, is on the caliber of the leadership coming in. And not to begrudge Ronnie Jackson, because he's had an outstanding career as a physician and a military career. But this is a whole other principle. I mean, we can see in Georgia, we've had a number of our prisons privatized, for example, and that has netted a very good return for us as a state. But that is very well managed.
With a few very bad exceptions.
Right. But it has been managed. It has been a managed process. And here's the question. Is this a manageable process? And is the new leader capable of managing that type of
process?
And
what goes along with that, buddy, is the fact that this is another example. Typically, the way you would vet the next secretary, another cabinet member, is you would have lower level White House administration people bringing in a list of names, looking carefully at their resumes, talking about them, interviewing them, and then finally presenting a choice to the president based on a knowledge and based on a research. The president just says, oh, Ronnie Jackson.
Bill, I couldn't agree with you more, but does anybody sitting here in this room seriously think that our friend, and he is our friend, Senator Johnny Isaacson, is going to buck the president here and say this man is not qualified, and that he will not be the next head of the VA? Right. I think not.
All right, I'm going to take a second on this because I have one last thing I want to do today. I'm going to say it, Jim, then you can react to this real quick. I think this is going to be an interesting test of the president and the United States and the Republicans in the Senate. I do think there's a possibility there may be pushback from Isaacson and others in the Senate.
But I will say that if there is pushback from Isaacson, we may not see it.
That's right. It might happen quietly. All right.
And this is not unprecedented. It's not like Ben Carson had much experience before he was put in his HUD either. So.
That's exactly right. All right. I asked Tom Faust for just a minute because I try to remain as open-minded and as neutral as I can in our political conversations, but I'm a Chicago boy. And one of the stops on my trip from Skokie to downtown Chicago on the L was at Loyola University every day. And Loyola University tomorrow night plays Michigan for the right to go into the national championship, and I am not going to remain neutral. I line up with Sister Jean, the 98-year-old nun who has been the mascot of the Loyola Rambler basketball team for the last two decades. And in this time in which we are so divided by partisan disloyalty, listen to what she said just today.
Well, I like to pray for both teams so that especially the fans who might hear me know that I'm partly on one side, but only partly. Because at the end of the prayer, I always ask God to be sure that the scoreboard indicates that the Ramblers have the big W.
I'm on Sister Jean's side. I don't know who you all have, but I'm a Loyola man all the way till Monday night.
This is the woman who has given up losing for Lent.
That's
wonderful.
That's
wonderful.
It. Buddy Darden, Michael Owens, Loretta Laporte, Jim Galloway, thanks for being with us. Everybody, thank you for being with us for a Political Rewind. See you next time.